from New England Public Radio in Springfield, the one in Massachusetts. This is NEPR News Now, stories you really should not miss. Thanks for listening. I'm Sam Hudzik, the news director at New England Public Radio. On this episode, we talk about mac and cheese, shower curtains, deodorant, and sperm.
Males may have to, you know, be a little concerned of what their environmental health and what they're consuming, what they're eating prior to conception.
Then we're going to stop in for a visit to our shortlist studio where our panel of journalists gets salty.
Ron, what do you think about this idea and his description of Springfield?
Oh, I believe Springfield should be the capital because the Easter Bunny and the Tooth Fairy told me so.
And we wrap up our back-to-school book series with a debut novel inspired by the author's own upbringing and helping his mom as she juggled two jobs.
You know, we're taking out trash and scrubbing toilets and wiping down desks and whatnot, and mom kept on doing it and, like, kept on doing it. And this idea of getting it done. It's, you know, it's like the lyric in the Hamilton song, immigrants, we get the job done.
All that coming up on NEPR News Now. But let's stick with the immigrant theme for a few minutes. Those living illegally in New England and around the country have reason these days to be on edge. President Trump's enhanced enforcement priorities are leading to increased arrests, and reports of federal immigration agents showing up at schools and courts are heightening fear among people in the country without authorization. But what happens when that fear is used as a weapon? For the New England News Collaborative, WBUR's Shannon Dooling tells us how immigration status is used to torment and intimidate, and why more people may be looking for a way out.
Antonia, who lives north of Boston, is nervous about being deported back to the Dominican Republic. She traveled here on a tourist visa and stayed in the country longer than she was authorized. But the mother of three has an even bigger fear, her ex-boyfriend.
Esa persona me golpeaba la boca, me gritaba.
He hit me in the mouth, he yelled at me, he broke my phone, until one day I couldn't take it anymore because he grabbed a knife and threatened me and my children. Antonia says her ex grabbed a knife from her kitchen and ran around checking under the beds for another man who didn't exist. In his rage, Antonia says he waved the knife around, threatening to kill her and her children. Her 8-year-old daughter hid behind the couch. Because she fears for her safety, we're only using part of her first name. Her ex-boyfriend is a naturalized U.S. citizen, also from the Dominican Republic. She says after they first met, he'd give her rides and help her with her English homework. But all of that changed.
Por eso yo no quería volver a estar más con esa persona y...
I didn't want to be with him anymore, and I separated from him, and I distanced myself, but he kept looking for me and calling me. And one day he called me and asked me to go to his house, and that's when it started all over again. He started hitting me. He bit me on this hand, and I told him, this isn't okay. You're hurting me. I'm going to have to call the police, but I don't know how to speak English. So I grabbed my children and left. And it wasn't just the bloody lip, the bite marks, or the bruises. Antonia says her ex riddled her with psychological abuse as well. He knew she'd overstayed her visa and knew she was terrified of being separated from her children. I was afraid every time he did something to me because I couldn't call the police, because he'd say to me that if I called the police, they're going to deport me. And I regret this because this is how he got away with the abuse. He just kept doing the same thing.
Essentially, they're having to choose between safety and deportation, and often it's not so clear-cut.
Julie Dahlstrom is director of Boston University's Immigrants' Rights and Human Trafficking Program. She says for survivors like Antonia, weighing the certainty of an abusive household versus the uncertainty of deportation can be a difficult choice.
You know, when a survivor picks up the phone and they're undocumented, they don't know who's going to be on the other end of the line. It is law enforcement, but they don't know how closely they're connected with immigration, which is really challenging.
There is an avenue to protection that a growing number of immigrants are considering a viable option. Some people living here without authorization who've been victims of crime in the U.S. are eligible for protection from deportation. They can apply for what's known as a U visa. More than 400 applications were submitted last fiscal year by New England residents. Hema Sarang Saminsky is a senior attorney at Boston's Victim Rights Law Center. She says the lengthy wait for a U visa used to be a deterrent for clients, but that appears to be changing under the Trump administration.
It does feel like, you know, survivors are more willing to take that chance and wait for the U visa in the current climate, I think largely because of a concern of, you know, not having anything else to fall back on.
And they are taking a chance. While waiting for approval of the visa, applicants have no legal status and no work authorization. While she hasn't seen the same uptick in her Burlington, Vermont practice, immigration attorney Leslie Holman says she understands why some undocumented immigrants might consider the U visa their only option for some kind of status. She cautions, though, it's anything but a safe bet.
The difficulty is the limit in the number of U visas, such that it may not necessarily provide a benefit, and the fact that it still doesn't provide the unfortunate victim with any kind of protection because they are not in status by filing.
The Office of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services issues 10,000 U visas nationwide a year. There are close to 170,000 pending applications. The first step in the application process is filing with a law agency to certify the crime took place and the victim was helpful in an investigation. That could mean applying with a police department or a district attorney's office. Jake Wark is spokesman for the Suffolk County DA's office.
There's really no question that we've seen a very sharp rise in the overall number of applications since this time last year.
Wark says they've seen close to a tripling of U visa applications, from 19 between January 1st and August 1st of 2016, up to 52 during that same time period this year. Nationwide, there have been concerns that unauthorized immigrants will be less likely to report crimes to local authorities, given President Trump's broadened enforcement priorities. In fact, a recent survey of advocates and lawyers finds there has been a drop in reports of crime by undocumented immigrants in some parts of the country. But still, for others who may have been victims of crime in the past, desperation may be winning over, and some hope is better than none. Again, Hema Sarang Saminsky of the Victim Rights Law Center.
I think that survivors are really thinking about, you know, what are avenues to safety right now. And there's just so much uncertainty that having some kind of application for relief in the works, it feels like it could result in some additional protection or safety right now.
And for Antonia, who just recently filed her U visa application, she says she's grateful for at least the possibility of protection. I mean, really, I think there are people who are treating women badly and abusing women just because they know they're not here legally. But we have rights, too. We have rights that we don't know about. That's the reality. Antonia feels a little relief now that her application is in. Immigration attorneys say the current wait for a U visa is anywhere between 2 and 6 years. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Shannon Dooling.
Now a look at a new study out of UMass Amherst. We've all been told that expectant mothers should avoid alcohol and smoking during and preferably before pregnancy. Well, what about expectant fathers? Here's Professor Rick Pilsner.
When I started thinking about having children with my wife, as a toxicologist, I gave her a list of things that she should not be consuming. Okay, you know, slow down on the alcohol. Not a big drinker anyway. But don't start smoking. It's good. And she's a very strong woman from Long Island. So she threw it right back at me and said, well, what about you? And at the time, I kind of laughed because there was no information on environmental health and sperm and reproductive success.
Now there is, after Pilsner and other researchers teamed up with the In Vitro Fertilization Clinic of Bay State Medical Center. They took urine samples from men on the same day their sperm was collected. Pilsner tells New England Public Radio's Kari Injiri they found significant amounts of phthalates, which are known to affect sperm quality and possible early life development.
Phthalates are a class of endocrine-disrupting compounds, and what they are, there's two major classifications, high molecular weight versus low molecular weight, and more the high molecular weight are plasticizers that make plastics more pliable, and they're used in many products vinyl flooring, your shower curtain. And what's interesting about these is they're not chemically bound to the product, so they can easily leach out.
You mean to say if you're taking a shower and you have one of those curtains, the phthalate could leach onto your skin?
Potentially. I think the more concern is maybe vinyl flooring where it gets kicked up in dust and then you're inhalating those compounds.
Breathing
in, right. So another main source of the high molecular weight phthalates are coming from processed foods.
Such as?
A big study just came out probably a month ago looking at phthalates in the powdered cheese that comes with different companies' mac and cheese. But a big component of exposure comes from processed food in general. So the more plastic that is wrapped in your food, if you're going to a supermarket and there's prepared food that's wrapped in plastic, has a plastic container and has plastic wrap on top to seal the product.
You mentioned high and low.
Right. So the low molecular weight phthalates are used primarily as stabilizers for perfume or scents. So we consider personal care products, so deodorants or aftershave, anything that really has a scent to it has most likely has phthalates in to stabilize that scent.
So the takeaway would be to not use deodorant or perfume if you're looking to conceive?
I think choosing the right brand would be the best way. And so you may want to avoid those that have heavy scents, maybe not using aftershave, maybe not using lotion, body lotion that has some sort of chemical scent to it.
We still don't know if this is on par with things that we know affect conception, smoking, drinking,
right.
Stress.
This is still, this is a prelim study. I think, once we get more data, we'll be more confident to kind of directly compare. But this is absolutely having an effect. So, the focus on pregnant women, that they're carrying a baby for 9.5 months and that they should be very careful and mindful of what they're putting in their body. Men don't have to worry during that 9.5 months because their job is done. But if you look at the preconception period, sperm take about 72 days to mature. So if you're planning on conceiving at a certain date, males may have to be a little concerned of what their environmental health and what they're consuming, what they're eating prior to conception.
Rick Pilsner is a professor at UMass Amherst. The study appears in the current issue of Human Reproduction. Now, a follow-up to a segment in our last episode. It was about a suggestion, perhaps a tongue-in-cheek one, for Massachusetts to auction off the state house, sell it for condos, and move the state capital from Boston to Springfield. This proposal came up in our weekly news roundtable, The Shortlist. Host Adam Frenier was chatting with Mike Dobbs of the Reminder Newspapers and Ron Shimelis of the Springfield Republican. Let's listen to a bit of their conversation.
Recently, a former Boston City Councilor wrote in Boston Magazine that Springfield should become the new capital of Massachusetts. Michael Ross says the State House in Boston should be sold off for condos and lawmakers should move west. He says it's one way to jumpstart Springfield's economy.
Other states have done it. Dozens of states have relocated their state capital. Many have done so with an eye towards economic development.
Mike, in this piece, he compared Springfield to Detroit and said the city is, quote, dying. He did backpedal a little bit on that, though, when we interviewed him. But is that a fair description of Springfield?
Springfield is not dying. Springfield is not dying. Springfield is not dying. Let me just say that three times. I love the idea of moving either state office buildings to Springfield, much less the state capital. I don't agree with the idea that the largest city in the state, the most influential city in the state, should be a state capital. Look to our neighbors in New York City, New York City and Albany. I think New York probably benefits from having the capital of Albany. So as someone who's a Springfield partisan, come on over. The water's fine.
Ron, what do you think about this idea and his description of Springfield?
Oh, I believe Springfield should be the capital because the Easter Bunny and the Tooth Fairy told me so. I don't know why he brings this up. If anybody has a case to be the capital, it might be Worcester because it's central location. But this is not going to happen. It's fun to talk about. I can't talk about it without smiling. And Mike's right. Springfield is not dying. It's starting to make something of a comeback. And it should be allowed to do that. But the capital will be Boston until our great-grandchildren have their own children.
That was Ron Chmielewicz and Mike Dobbs, along with NEPR's Adam Frenier. If you liked what you hear, check out the shortlist, NEPR's Week in Review. That's on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Now we'll finish up with a pick from our back-to-school book series with a tale of good versus evil. Imagine a chaotic, unjust world where society's least powerful are forced to literally eat the sins of the powerful. One of these sin eaters, a boy named Taj, becomes the unlikely hero in this fantasy, Beasts Made of Night. New Haven author Tochi Onyebuchi tells New England Public Radio's Tema Silk how his work with incarcerated people influenced his writing.
One of the things that I had wanted to work with was this idea of sin and how it melds with guilt and the idea of who gets punished for what, particularly with my background in criminal justice and working with issues of incarceration. This is something that's weighed heavily on my mind. And to find a way to dramatize it as I've been able to do in a fantasy setting was very important to me.
A fundamental issue in the book is power versus powerlessness. Mm-hmm. But Taj, who feels powerless, has it within him tremendous power, mm-hmm. which gets realized over the course of the book.
Particularly being a person of color in the United States, you know, we're constantly confronted with these situations, both on a macro scale, particularly given what's going on with DACA at the moment, but also on a micro scale in our interactions with various other people. You know, you're constantly running up against sense of powerlessness, or you're confronted with the vast imbalance in the power dynamic between you and, say, the powers that be or a member of the majority culture. And it could get so pervasive that it becomes the baseline of your existence, or it becomes the very air you breathe. One of the things that I wanted to show in Taj is how, at the same time, we are vessels of immense power. We can accomplish such incredible things, and we are necessary. I think that was a message that I wanted to sort of put out there.
And what's the quality that Taj has that brings him out of his dire circumstances, would you say? Or what are the qualities?
I think this persistence that he has in doing this thing that he knows he has to do, it's a horrible job. It's a really horrible job. And the pay is awful. But he keeps on doing it. And, you know, he has to provide for his family and feed himself and whatnot. And, you know, I'm always thinking of, particularly at one point, my mother, her second job was custodial, and she would bring us kids along to, you know, clean these office buildings. It was awful. You know, we would, as kids, turn it into a bit of a game, but, you know, we're taking out trash and scrubbing toilets and wiping down desks and whatnot. And Mom kept on doing it and, like, kept on doing it. And this idea of getting it done. It's, you know, it's like the lyric in the Hamilton song, immigrants, we get the job done. That is something that I think powers Taj on his journey. I think also his ability to grow into someone who cares for other people. I think
because if he just kept getting the job done, he would have ended up powerless, totally
exactly.
powerless. That's the nature of being a sin eater, but
exactly.
So something else pushes him.
Exactly. And that's, you know, being able to care for other people and trying to figure out a way to better not just his own circumstances, but the circumstances of people that he cares about.
I see you're wearing a T-shirt that says second generation Nigerian. And in your acknowledgments, you mentioned that your mother, quote, held Nigeria in her bosom while traversing an ocean and brought that place into our household, end quote. In what ways, are there any ways that you'd say that the writing of Beasts Made of Night was influenced by your connections to Nigerian culture?
Writing Beasts was a way for me to reconnect with a lot of that. I'm, you know, a very Americanized second generation Nigerian, but at the same time, Nigeria is very meaningful to me. It's a place that I draw a lot of pride from with regards to my identity. And at the same time, too, it's a place that gave birth to my mother. It's the place that spirited her across the Atlantic Ocean to, you know, the United States, where she's built this life for herself and this family. And her history there is absolutely fascinating. As a child, she lived through the Civil War and the military dictatorships that followed. And oftentimes when she speaks about Lagos, where she spent a significant portion of her life, she talks of this city that's just a mass of chaos and everything's going on all at once. There's a lot of crime and, you know, you have street vendors selling food and the traffic is just legendary. But she says this all with the biggest smile on her face. And I can tell that there's no other city on the planet for which she guards this much affection. Drawing on that was very important to me in the writing of this book.
That was Tochi Onyebuchi, author of Beasts Made of Night, which will be released at the end of October. That interview was the last from our Back to School book series. You can check out all the selections at NEPR.net. This podcast is produced by New England Public Radio, a listener-supported public media company that brings you news and music at NEPR.net. Check it out, and while you're there, you can make a contribution to New England Public Radio. Click the orange donate button at the top of the screen. Thank you so much for listening, and if you liked what you hear, or even if you didn't, I guess, don't forget to leave a review for NEPR News Now on iTunes. Much appreciated. Until next time.